Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Monday, June 24th, 2024. A South Sudanese group says dozens of orphans are trapped in Khartoum.
We don't have mobilities that can take us from Reng to Khartoum, where the orphans' kids are. If God wishes, if the well wishes or our donors, maybe may respond.
And a satellite imaging expert says the siege of El Fasher has subsided for now, but he says he doesn't expect that to last for long.
There appears to be calm, but we also have credible reports that both sides are rapidly rearming and awaiting reinforcements.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Dozens of orphans and elderly women are said to be trapped in Sudan's Khartoum, the capital. South Sudan Women United, an organization taking care of them in Khartoum, says the orphans and elderly persons have requested to be relocated to Port Sudan, but a funding gap has been delaying that process. Memer Abraham Kuat reports for VOA from Rank.
Bol Geapuch, field project manager for South Sudan Women United in Reng, says the organization is taking care of dozens of orphan Sudanese children and several elderly women in Khartoum. He says the children wanted to be relocated to a safer place 2 months ago, but the lack of funding has forced the group to stay in Khartoum, where fighting has raged for more than a year between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces.
We are supporting 48 girls and boys, 7 elderly women. In total, they are 55. Those orphans, they are under our care as the South Sudan Women United. We are supporting them with the basic need, and they now request us to relocate them from where they are currently to Port Sudan, of which the preparation is underway. Probably on 27th or 28th of this month, they will be relocated to Port Sudan. This is where they requested, which is a safer place for them, because where they are right now, the security is not that safe.
However, the move may not happen on time, Ball says, because the team in Reng is unable to travel to Khartoum to help relocate the group because they are running out of funds.
In Sudan, currently, they don't go to school. They don't get proper medication because the hospitals are not there. Maybe if there is private clinics, but the prices are high. The challenge that we are facing, that is for our team in Reng, maybe one or two, to go and support the team in Khartoum to relocate these people. We don't have mobilities that can take us from Reng to Khartoum, where the open kids are. If God wishes, if the well wishes or our donors, if they maybe may respond, then we will definitely relocate these orphans. The challenge is lack of funding.
The United Nations Children's Fund says over 4 million children have been forcefully displaced internally and across borders. UNICEF also says about 600,000 people had crossed to South Sudan from Sudan, including more than 302,000 children. Wiel Garbak is the representative of community leaders in Reng's Transit Center 1 and says there are several orphans and unaccompanied minors at the center.
Orphans and accompanies are also gathering here. I should say like 20, nowhere to be taken. Now the one of sharing start facing us within the Transit Center. I hope if we are here with NGOs, they will be taken somewhere where they are supposed to be. I've seen nowadays there is no support that, especially some NGOs, they don't support much because whenever they support at once. Often it's where to stay, especially like rooms, woods, and also bed where to sleep. As a community leader, also we try to talk with the families who are staying here within the camp to keep them with them.
Ruth Kirui is the head of the UN Refugee Agency's field office in Reng in Upper Nile State. She says UNHCR had not been informed there are orphans trapped in Sudan.
We are not aware of that because I know we have our colleagues on the other side and also other partners who are responding to Sudan's situation. So that has not come to any of our attention. But of course, if it comes to our attention, we will of course flag it off to our colleagues in Sudan to assess, first of all, the situation, and also if there are partners working in that particular locality, I'm sure they will do their best to see how well that can be responsive.
She says limited funding dictates that services are offered to persons with special needs first.
We have documented over 100 cases of the children who are much more at risk. We prioritize the unaccompanied separated children because these are special categories of children who majority of them come without caregivers or do not really have foster care arrangements in place. And that is why upon arrival to the transit center, they're always prioritized for documentation and also placements to other care alternative caregivers.
UNICEF says some 13 million children affected by Sudan's conflict are in need of humanitarian assistance. For VOA News, I am Amir Abram Kwad, reporting from Reng, Upper Nile State.
An analysis of satellite imagery and video from the Sudanese city of El Fasher in Darfur last month showed entire villages being burned, reportedly by the paramilitary rapid support forces. If the city falls to the RSF, analysts say it could lead to a whole new wave of massacres. The RSF and the Sudanese army have been locked in a battle for control of Sudan since April of last year, driving millions from their homes and killing tens of thousands of unarmed people. Nathaniel Raymond, executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health, who analyzed satellite imagery over Darfur's El Fasher, tells me that in recent weeks, the fighting has subsided, but he says that's likely because of rain.
The UN Security Council passed UNSC Resolution 2736 the Thursday before last. We have not seen any signs of new major damage inside the city, nor have we seen significant thermal activity consistent with arson attacks in the area surrounding El Fasher. There appears to be calm, but we also have credible reports that both sides are rapidly rearming and awaiting reinforcements. Rather than seeing this as a temporary ceasefire by accident, it is likely the result of rain. It has started raining in El Fasher, which has probably impeded RSF's ability to move.
Oh, that's interesting. You mentioned at the top of your remarks that this UN Security Council action. Can you elaborate a little?
The United Nations Security Council took action almost 2 weeks ago to call for the rapid support forces to stop its siege of El Fasher. Since that time, the heavy fighting that had been happening since May 10th appears to have subsided. The resolution calls for humanitarian access to be provided by all parties, in particular Sudan Armed Forces.
Can you even tell that if now, you know, if there are corridors now for humanitarian, and can you tell from your imagery if that's working?
There's no sign of humanitarian corridors, both in terms of imagery, but also in terms of what's known through open source information. People have fled to the west, to Tawila, and to the south towards Zamzam IDP camp. And we see evidence that people have fled, and we see evidence of new internally displaced persons settlements, both to the south and inside Tawila. But there's no humanitarian operation to supply those people who have fled El Fasher.
I saw some of that video that was posted, and it's very frightening. If you were to go back a little further and talk about that video where it shows El Fasher burning in at least this village that I was looking at, and everything in it just seems to be on fire. Can you talk about what's going on there in terms of the RSF burning what looks to be like entire villages?
So since the April 15th, 2023 civil war began in Sudan, rapid support forces have been attacking Masalit, Fur, and Zagawa communities in Darfur, which are non-Arab. And when they attack these communities, they primarily use arson, and they light the roofs of their traditional huts, called tukuls, on fire. And when they light these huts, which are made out of grass and dung and mud, they burn very quickly because it's organic material. Sometimes when we are overhead collecting an image, we see the houses still on fire. And they burn with a very distinctive thermal scarring pattern. We call this pattern often donuts because the houses in many cases are circular and the roof will fall in and create white ash in the center and then a black ring around the outside.
Do you know if the inhabitants of these tukuls are able to get out first before this happens or not?
It depends. We have confirmation in the early phase in April in the town of Serba in the early part of the Civil War. They surrounded people in that town and burned them alive.
That's Nathaniel Raymond, executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. He was speaking to me earlier today from New Haven, Connecticut. Some internally displaced persons in Tambura County of South Sudan's western Equatoria state say they fear returning to their homes despite the security situation across Tambura County being relatively safe of late. Mattia Samuel Timatio reports from Yambio.
In May of this year, Western Equatoria State Tambura County was the scene of killings, kidnapping, disappearance, and property destruction in a rush of intercommunal attacks between the Azande and Balanda militias. An estimated 26,000 civilians were displaced by the clashes, and most residential areas around Tambura Town were reported to be deserted. Kapi Joseph, an IDP representative who spoke to VOA on Friday from Tambura, says most families have been sheltering in a church or at a United Nations mission in South Sudan base. Joseph says most of the IDPs say they are afraid to return to their villages.
People are still fearing, still they don't have confidence. What is causing all this is people living and staying in the camps is just a fear. Returning home is just a voluntary thing. If you think that you can go home and nothing can happen to you, it is your right to go home. Everyone is planning to go back home. But if it is not safe, that is why also you see most of the people are still living in the camps.
Joseph says, despite the reported calm, most people are not yet confident the intercommunal violence is gone for good.
There is no killing, there is no fight.
Actually, there is no killing. There is no fighting. Again, people don't trust each other. The other thing is that people are not many there in the area. When you go back to your home and you see that your neighbor is not there, you cannot stay alone. But if the situation comes to normal, I'm quite sure that everyone will go home.
Anangwarago, one of the IDPs in Tambura County, says she feels safe in the camp and does not want to leave just yet.
The situation is still not fine. That is why we are here. Most of the people are still in the camps. The reason why we are not going back to the home is that the crisis of gun is worse than the one of knife and panga. Because at times you can be killed in the bush. You will not know anyone. The situation of the camp is a bit better than the one of home.
Apai Paul John is the Western Equatoria State Director General at South Sudan's Commission for Relief and Rehabilitation. He says over 15,000 IDPs are sheltering in camps in the Catholic Church and Yenmes base in Tambura.
There are very many people whom their houses were burned, then maybe things like food items. So this is whereby they are facing difficulty to go there. And also there is fear in them. Although the situation is calm in Tambura, but still there is fear. Someone is thinking maybe if I go, something may happen again. Maybe with the time, they will start going voluntarily. Those who are near the town, they are at least going back to their places. But those who are really a bit far, they fear because also it's rain season and grasses has started growing up higher, so they have that fear.
Matthew Mabenge, the commissioner of Tambura County, assured the residents in Western Equatoria State that South Sudan People Defend Force has restored relative calm across the county. For VOA News, I am Mattia Samuel Timatio in Western Equatoria State, Yambio.
Thank you. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, a Michigan congressman with a large Sudanese diaspora in his district travels to Africa. Stay tuned. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Congressman Dan Kildee represents the 8th District in the U.S. state of Michigan. That's in the Midwest of the country. He was touring Africa this past week as part of a congressional delegation and tells VOA's Yehias Wuhib that the purpose of the visit is first and foremost to reauthorize the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA as it's known, as well as to remain engaged with the continent. He also discusses the needs of Sudan with Yehias, as there is a large contingency of the Sudanese diaspora in his district.
For those currently AGOA-eligible countries, we want to do a couple of things. One, substantially enhance the trade relationship. And we're on this particular trip, we're visiting 4 countries, Cape Verde, Kenya, Tanzania, and the Gambia, each of them with dramatically different economies and significantly different levels of engagement, but for each of them, an upside. So for us, it's increasing and modernizing AGOA to deal with the economy as it is right now, increasing trade, moving away from more of an extraction relationship where raw material or agricultural products are at the center of this, but really think about value-added investment.
And also, U.S. interests in the region, in Africa, are increasingly undermined by China and Russia and other powers to fill the policy spaces left vacant by the United States and other Western nations. So is that something you think about and try to kind of close the gap?
For sure. I think one good example for me, because it's something I've been involved with personally, is the condition in Sudan. You know, I visited Khartoum for the first time under the prior regime and was very much involved in trying to encourage that democracy movement. Obviously, we've seen pretty significant slippage in what was once a hopeful scenario, but the lack of U.S. engagement made my job much more difficult. Because unless we're, significantly economically invested, it's very hard for us to make suggestions or encourage democracy without showing the tangible benefit of a capitalist economy, a democratic governance. We've got to be able to do more than just say the words. We have to deliver. And that's, like when I mentioned Sudan, it's been a particular frustration for me. I have a Sudanese American population that I've been working with, the diaspora, and I want to be able to have a stronger hand. The U.S. can be a force for good, but we can't be a force for good by just sending the equivalent of a get well card. We've got to be present. We have to be economically engaged.
And it's not only Sudan, but the surrounding countries, the neighboring countries, are being affected by what is happening in Sudan.
No question about it. It's destabilizing. It makes it much more difficult. Security is one issue, but when there's not individual security, when there's no national security, it's very difficult to have any kind of economic security, any kind of significant direct investment when the security situation is such that it dissuades significant capital from wanting to invest. We've got to fix that.
And Congressman, surveys demonstrate a fairly consistent support for both democratic norms and accountable governance in most African countries, and therefore a value-led foreign policy that reinforces democratic norms and accountable governance would be expected to find public support in Africa, even if it rankles incumbent autocratic leaders.
That's exactly right, and we know we can't do it with a snap of a finger. Africa is a huge continent, a billion people, with growing population in many of these countries. But we have to start somewhere. And we have some areas where we can make very significant progress in more developed places. But we also, even in those nations that are struggling economically, our influence could be tremendous, showing the way, showing that engaging will potentially also support the march toward the democratic institutions, toward democratic principles. And you're exactly right. The people that I have spoken to here on the continent, the people in these countries, they aspire, everyone, for the same things everybody else does. They want to be able to determine their own future, whether that's as an individual for their families or as a people, as a nation.
That is United States Congressman Dan Kildee of Michigan. He was speaking with my colleague Yehias Wuhib. After multiple delays and court challenges, it appears now that the deployment of Kenyan police officers to Haiti may be set for tomorrow. That's according to the latest news reports. This comes after Kenya's high court ruled earlier this year that such a deployment was unconstitutional. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, Mariama Diallo, has the story.
Kenyan police officers may be set for deployment to Haiti on Tuesday, according to local reports and the French news agency AFP. Multiple inquiries to the government of Kenya for confirmation of such reports were not answered. This development comes after many delays and court challenges, including the newest lawsuit that accused Kenyan President William Ruto of contempt of court. Last year, a United Nations Security Council resolution approved the Kenyan-led mission, but earlier this year, the High Court of Kenya ruled against the deployment, saying it was unconstitutional. Issues cited by the court include the lack of a reciprocal agreement between the countries. The Kenyan government eventually secured that agreement, but the same people who sued the government in the first place filed another lawsuit seeking to block the deployment. Wallace Nderu is a lawyer and a program officer at ICJ Kenya, the International Commission of Jurists, a non-governmental, non-profit, member-based organization. From a legal perspective, he tells VOA, the legitimacy of the agreement is still in question.
The grounds for this application is that, one, when the then Prime Minister of Haiti was signing this agreement with Kenya, there was no known government in Haiti. The president had been assassinated. There was no elected leaders in Haiti. So where he derived the mandate to be able to execute the agreement on behalf of his country, Haiti, comes into question.
Nderu also says Kenyans feel that this agreement was hastily put together, noting its content has not been shared with the population.
Part of the provisions in the law, and especially Section 107 of that particular act I mentioned, being the National Police Service Act, indicates that this agreement, after its signing, has to be gazetted in the official Kenya Gazette. So a concern is raised. This particular agreement is very secretive. We're not aware of the contents of this particular agreement. This is the legitimacy of the government deploying the police to Haiti.
A new commander for the police force was appointed on Monday by the Inspector General. President Ruto has always maintained that stabilizing the troubled Caribbean nation is, quote, a mission for humanity, a mission for solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Haiti, unquote. In addition to Kenya, other nations, including Benin, the Bahamas, Bangladesh, Barbados, and Chad, said they will join the mission as well. While some Kenyans support the mission in Haiti, others have wondered why their country wants to lead the multinational force, given that nations more powerful and better equipped have not been willing to step forward. This reported deployment will be taking place on the same day that protests against proposed tax increases that have rocked Kenya in the past week are set to resume. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps it up for us this Monday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Bendeka by Dudu Kopa.
Mon best le motivateur des motivés. Mon gars, quoi?
Listening to Bandeco by Dodo Copa. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington, and on behalf of our engineer, Helen Cordrian, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A second cargo ship has reportedly sunk in the Red Sea after being attacked by Houthis. On June 12th, the Greek-owned MV Tudor was targeted by a bomb-carrying drone boat and other projectiles. A crew member of the Tudor was killed, bringing to four the number of sailors who have died in such attacks. On June 13th, the Houthis attacked the Ukrainian-owned MV Verbena, severely wounding a mariner who had to be medically evacuated. The U.S. Defense Department reports that since November 19th, there have been 190 attacks on commercial vehicles by the Houthis. Most have been thwarted by U.S. and international forces, but tragically not all. The Yemen-based, Iran-backed Houthis have escalated their drone and missile strikes on commercial shipping following Hamas's terror attack on Israel on October 7th and Israel's subsequent military operation to root out Hamas in Gaza. With their assaults on commercial shipping, the Houthis claim to be acting on behalf of Palestinians, yet as National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby noted, they are targeting and threatening the lives of third country nationals who have nothing to do with that conflict.
The Houthis killed an innocent crew member from the Philippines and critically wounded a Sri Lankan sailor who were guilty of no crimes, who were simply doing their jobs as professional mariners. They weren't delivering arms to Israel. They weren't taking sides in the Middle East. They were just manning their posts aboard ship, trying to earn a paycheck and keep global commerce moving. This is pure terrorism. There's simply no other word for it.
Even the Yemeni people have been victimized, said communications advisor Kirby, as the Houthis struck a ship that was bringing grain to their own ports.
These attacks also obstruct humanitarian aid to Sudan, where the needs are tremendous and the conditions desperate, and they impact commerce for every neighboring country in the Horn of Africa and the Middle East.
As part of a U.S. government-wide effort to thwart attacks by the Houthis, the Treasury Department announced new sanctions designations against individuals and entities that are involved in the Houthi weapons procurement network. These Houthi attacks are truly reckless, said communications advisor Kirby. They don't care a whit about Palestinians in Gaza. It's terrorism, as I said, pure and simple, and it has to stop.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.